WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. All of our Crab Cake Tour stuff is brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. I've been letting myself play. I've been giving away Raven scratch-offs. I gave one away at Costas right after John Martin left. $50 winner at Costas. So come on out. We're going to be doing it at Nacho Mama's in the beginning of January. I'm working on the Raven schedule, but... you know, ho, 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 and down the chimney, and here comes Santa Claus and the trees and the holidays and all the cool things to do around town, including movies, which I think of her, and playing various musical instruments as well. Don Moeller, one of our defending champions, one of our favorites, is here, and I think she should have been the real host of Jeopardy. That's what I think.
That would be interesting. The managing editor-in-chief of Baltimore Magazine. We just call her the chief. Baltimore Magazine, December issue, almost history now because we're looking to January.
But January's coming soon.
Hey, man, how can you put Royal Farms on the cover and I'm not in there? Because I'm there always is, in Royal baby. Farms. I'm always in there getting fried chicken.
Now, when you check out the story online, which I believe it's online today, you are in there.
There you go, line. Nestor. You've been added.
What?
You're in there. No, look. See, you don't remember. You gave me a quote about why you love Royal Farms. And you got left on the cutting room floor of the magazine, the print edition. But you will be in the online version.
Was it the Western fries that I love the most? Or was it the world famous fried chicken? Which would it be?
Well, you tell me. I mean, I'm talking to the actual man right now. So, we talk about Western fries in the issue and they're controversial. I am not a fan of the Western fry. Yeah, I like a McDonald's French fry. Give me a free.
Oh, my God. Fruity. You're so off on
you
this.
Are,
I don't want. Thank you.
You yes, are Tom. My wife, Max's wife. Max, the girl, and my wife spirits. Okay. She doesn't touch a Western fry and she dies for the McDonald's fries.
She's from New Jersey. So hold on here.
Oh, let Max get
any French fry needs a potato. If it tastes like a potato, I like wedges. I love me some steak fries, you know. But Western fries at Rofo, I don't always get them. But when I do, I enjoy them immensely. But I've become a tenders guy lately, honestly, Max.
The tenders are good. I go for the tenders a lot. The thing about the Western fries, let me just finish this point. Is it's like, you know, you have this delicious chicken. It has this delicious breading on it and seasoning. And then it's like, and then alongside that, have some mealy potatoes that have the exact same breading and seasoning. Yeah. I like a little variety of texture and flavor in my meal. So I am not into the Western fry, but as you pointed out, we finally did a cover story on Royal Farms. It's called Rofo Nation. It's got that adorable cover illustration where you can find all these little Easter eggs and cute things on the cover. And, you know, the basic premise of the story is that people get very attached to their convenience stores, that, you know, like it becomes part of the civic identity, and that we relate to our convenience store in the same way that we do to our sports team. So we have like Royal Farms loyalty in Baltimore, whereas like in Philly, they would have Wawa, you know, Jersey and Philly.
We don't eat hoagies here. Forget them.
We talk a lot about Baltimore Magazine on here, and we always encourage folks, you know, get the subscription. I was looking on here, thought, you know, I better make sure my subscription's good to go. November 23. So I'm okay. I'm paid up through November 23. But it's so much cheaper. And I think, and react to this, Max, as the editor-in-chief, I think the December issue really is a snapshot of what makes Baltimore Magazine special. And let me say why. You've got this cover story about Rural Farms, and everybody in Maryland loves them some Rural Farm chicken, whether it's the chicken or whether it's the tenders.
I'm literally drinking the coffee right now. Am I literally?
And they love the coffee, and they've now upgraded the coffee. It's even better than it was before. Then Nestor and I spent a full hour today, two different segments, with Ron Cassie talking about what I believe will become an HBO special, his story on the prosecution of Keith Davis Jr. and what appears to be a real miscarriage of justice. I'll let other people draw their own conclusions. You can only do that by checking out the December issue.
Don't you love how he has the little pink things there, Max, like the school teacher?
That's the educator in me.
He was a social studies teacher by trade.
I gotta get to the notes.
And then there's a third story about a Baltimore icon, which I was so touched by. I reached out to Jerry right afterwards. Your story on Jerry Sandusky and the role that his mom played and the voice of the Ravens. And I don't think anybody's ever met Jerry that doesn't like Jerry. So you got these three stories that, to me, is that a goal? And where I'm going with that, Max, is it a goal of the magazine and you as the editor to give us those, like, that variety that keeps us coming back? Talk about that.
No, 100%. I mean, when we map out our stories and our issues, we always try to take a step back and look at the big picture and make sure that there is that variety of content that you can have a complete experience where you're going to be learning a lot and you're going to be hopefully laughing and you're going to find out about food and you're going to be enriched. And there's probably going to be at least one deep dive story like the Keith Davis story. And there's going to be a profile. And, you know, I always say we can't please all the people all the time, but we can try. You know, when you have a magazine like ours, you can have different stories that we think will appeal to a different reader, or maybe they'll like all the stories, but 100%, we are looking to sort of create that variety. And that's the fun of doing a more general lifestyle magazine like ours, that it's really like the sky's the limit. As long as it's Baltimore focused, we can pretty much write about anything that we want.
Max, I want to get you out for crab cake soon. Maybe I'm doing Nacho Mamas in next month, but at some point, I want to get you out and like take a deeper dive where you and I just yell at each other about media and just get it, go way in on that. But when I see you doing like deep dive, hard hitting stuff, that to me, that's not what BMag did back when you were Max the Girl at City Paper and I was Nestor the Boy at the Evening Sun. And that was more Sunday Sun type of thoughts. Or even Sun Magazine, which was much more bright and airy. Baltimore Magazine was feel good, feel good, feel good. But I think you guys, at some point, and I don't know where that is because it feels like you've been there forever, and I still call you the City Paper person, as well as Jen Marsh and a whole bunch of other people that have been here forever and a day. People still call me the sports guy, which is fine. But for me, when the journalism side comes in and we live here, and you say it isn't all bright and airy after Freddie, that we have to tell not just happy stories. And I know, and I ran into Steve the other day. I'm coming out of Liberatore's. I get a meatball. I almost run into Jeppy. It was like the old Reese's peanut butter cup. We almost ran each other over. And I think it's in his soul, because I know Steve well, that it would be Pleasantville. And stories about murders and guys getting shot behind refrigerators and whether they murdered the guy at Pimlico, that wasn't Baltimore Magazine's purview last century. You speak to that a little bit, and maybe I'm wrong, but probably not by much, but even more so that in the modern era, you have to be a little bit of everything, right?
Well, you're not wrong. We definitely used to lean in more to the strict lifestyle kind of stuff.
But what does that mean? Happy?
Well,
happy ending?
Well, no, but like, you know, best this, top that. It was always a lot of that. And we still do a fair amount of that, but we didn't do as many of these read pieces. We didn't do as many heavy hitting stories. A few things happened. One thing that happened was City Paper shut down, unfortunately.
And they did a hell of a lot of investigative work, and you had your soul there too. Right.
The second thing that happened is that unfortunately the Sun, their staff has shrunk considerably. So Baltimore has a need for more of that kind of reporting and writing. The other thing that happened is the demographics of our reader changed, the kinds of stories that they're looking for changed, because we're not just now sending out copies to, suburban households with a 200K plus yearly income. We're also on the internet and we're reaching a much wider swath of the audience. And we became aware of the fact that, look, Baltimore is a 65% Black city. We want to make sure that we are reaching all of the readers in Baltimore, not just some, you know, bougie elite sect. Nothing wrong with
not that. People like me, the bougie types, right?
People like me, you know, exactly. But you know, so it was just, it was shifting demographics in the city, shifting demographics on our staff, of our reader, and a need that we felt needed to be fulfilled in the city, journalistically speaking. And that's how you end up with these stories. And, you know, they've done well for us. The readers really, really like them. You know, when you've got, you talk to Ron all the time, when you've got a journalist like Ron Cassie, when you've got a journalist like Lydia Williver, Jane Marion, other people who write for us, they're very serious journalists. They work incredibly
hard. Lydia's so serious, I can't get her on to talk about crabs with me.
what we do that, you know, they can't do at The Sun, and for no fault of theirs, is we have a monthly publication. So we can live with our stories a little longer. We actually can drill down deeper, and we always try to give more context to the story. Because if you're following a story day to day in the Baltimore Sun, you might have some understanding of it. Well, we're going to put it all together, give you the full perspective, and also include some additional investigative reporting. I mean, some of the stuff that Ron Cassie put in the Keith Davis story, you're not going to see anywhere else. And it also comes together in such a way that it all makes sense. It's like you're seeing it all laid out like that. This guy being just, you know, prosecuted for a crime that all evidence points to the fact he did not commit.
Not prosecuted, well, repeatedly Max, prosecuted.
Yes. And Max, yes, it yes. has this wrinkle to it. And again, I would say to folks, do yourself a favor. Either go online, BaltimoreMagazine.net, or go to the newsstand and see if you can still find the December issue and read Ron Cassie's story on the prosecution of Keith Davis Jr. Because, Max, as we talked with Ron, the part that still is a puzzlement to me, if I play Yul Brynner, is it appears to be out of character for the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, who's not known as a lock 'em up, throw 'em away kind of prosecutor. That's the piece, and I read the parts on the state's attorney more than once in Ron's piece because it seemed incongruent to me. I can't figure it out.
Right. She's considered the progressive prosecutor and largely has lived up to that. So this does seem out of character for her. If you read the story, there's some indication of why this might have happened. And again, this is all, it's journalism. When I talked to Ron, I said, you know, let's be careful here because we're writing almost a defense of this guy.
Yes.
And, you know, if you think he did it, it's a bad look for us. And he was like, Max, I have investigated this from every single angle. While the story does not draw any specific conclusions, it comes pretty close to saying this guy didn't do it. And you have to understand the context, okay? This was right after Freddie Gray. It was a police shooting that they needed to justify. How do you justify a police shooting? You say this guy is a murderer. You say this. And now, maybe that's the case. This is all alleged. This is all, you know, based on our reporting and our understanding of what happened. But that's the context. Read the story. Read the story and form your own opinion.
And that's right. Hey, Max, speaking of read the story, I should have asked you this the many times we've had you on. What's the reach of Baltimore Magazine? Put a face on it. Like, how many people read it online? How many subscriptions? What is your readership? I'm sure you live and breathe that stuff.
No, I mean, I don't exactly have the exact statistics at my fingertips. I think we have something like 250,000 monthly who visit us online. We have a pass around circulation of about 75,000 for the issue itself. I don't have the exact numbers, so don't.
Those are big numbers, though. They're big numbers.
I mean, we're successful, and it's really been interesting that the BaltimoreMagazine.com, our social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, they've really expanded our reach and expanded our audience. And you know, it's at first, you know, I've been around so long. There wasn't even a BaltimoreMagazine.com when I first started at the magazine. And then very gradually we began putting up copies, but we didn't know what we were doing. You know, like in the beginning, we were just taking the copy from the magazine and plunking it online. And that's not the way to do it, because the internet has its own different rules and its own rhythms and the kinds of stories that, that work better on the internet. So now if you check out BaltimoreMagazine.com, you will see all of the wonderful print journalism, but you're going to see lots of blogs and lots of things about events. And, you know, it's been a good thing for us to have this. The only thing, and I think I've said this before, a pox on the person who first decided that nobody had to pay for access to a magazine's website, you know?
I think I told you the Bob Woodward story, one of the earlier visits. I went to see Woodward speak, and he was talking about the Post at the time. Now, of course, now they do have a paywall, but Woodward said he was called in by the publisher to ask his opinion. You know, the venerable Bob Woodward. And Woodward said, I'm a writer. I may not know much about that, but I can tell you, I'm not sure if we're concerned about declining readership and circulation, how giving it away for free helps our bottom line. He said, I'm not smart enough to figure that part out.
But you can't put the genie back in the bottle. I mean, so many things are free on the internet. People have that expectation. And we've, you know, considered a paywall. It's not completely off the table, but at this point, our readers are really used to accessing our content. Now, we put it up later, right? So the magazine comes out, and then about 3 weeks later, we start putting the copy online. So the subscribers, the people who get it off the newsstands, they're going to read all that copy first. But yeah, for now, you can get it all for free.
Well, we have the Baltimore Magazine editor-in-chief, Max Weiss, as one of our guests, but we also have the pop culture icon, Max the Girl, with the greatest of all Twitter feeds. So let's have some fun. I copied you in a post from my son a week or so ago, where he listed his 15 favorite Christmas movies, and you immediately fired back. No Die Hard, list is ineligible. So answer the age-old question, Max Weiss, is Die Hard a Christmas movie or is it not?
So here's the honest truth. I don't really care. It's one of those funny internet debates that there's never a right answer to. And yet, if you toss this out, this is like low hanging fruit. It's like sort of saying, is a hot dog a sandwich? You know what I mean? It's right up there with, is a hot dog a sandwich? Is Die Hard a Christmas film? I don't care, to be honest. I just find the debate amusing. It's set during Christmas, so it really depends on how much you know, is a Christmas film simply a film that takes place at the time of Christmas? Then absolutely Die Hard.
But you could say that about Home Alone, too, right?
Many consider Home Alone a Christmas film.
Sure, yes. I would.
See?
So, I've heard that.
Right, so it depends on how you define it.
When you talk about real movies and classic movies, I can get in this conversation.
Well, see, that was Jeff. Lester knows my son. When I immediately yelled at my son, come on, dude, no White Christmas. He goes, here was his answer to that, Max. Dad, just because they have a Christmas tree at the end of the movie and put on a Santa hat doesn't make it a Christmas movie. He wasn't even buying White Christmas as a Christmas movie.
I mean, that's tough. I mean, White Christmas, if it's got Christmas in the title, I think we can safely say it's a Christmas movie.
What are the two or three? We all have two or three that we queue up every season. What are the two or three that if you don't see them, it's not Christmas?
Well, I don't have that. And it's not just because I'm Jewish.
I don't either, by the way. I don't either.
I don't get into
I know you're Jewish, but Jewish people watch Christmas movies.
No. That's why I said it's not because I'm Jewish. It's just because of my temperament. I'm not the kind of person who likes to watch movies over and over again. I don't feel I need to sort of mark the season. What I will say is that, you know, I have loved both of the recent, not so recent, Little Women. I thought Greta Gerwig's Little Women was amazing. I love the Little Women with Winona Ryder. Don't Make Me Pick. I love them both equally. You know, Timothy Chalamet, Christian Bale. How can you choose? I consider those great Christmas films, and I love those. I am going to recommend, maybe not everybody has seen The Family Man with Nicolas Cage.
One of my very favorites.
It's kind of like an updated version of It's a Wonderful Life. And they were clearly trying to go for that, trying to sort of turn it into a classic Christmas film that people watch every
year. I've never seen it. So how classic can it be?
Nestor, well, Don Cheadle.
For some reason. Yes.
As an angel. What else do you need to know? Don Cheadle as an angel.
It never took off the way I think it deserves to take off. It's actually a very heartwarming film. So he's this kind of like corporate mover and shaker who went on, he kind of left his childhood sweetheart to become this like rich hotshot on Wall Street, whatever. And then an angel comes and gives him a chance to see what his life would have been like if he had married his high school sweetheart. And he, at first, he hates it. I mean, you know, he doesn't have his Ferrari anymore. He doesn't have his, you know, his espresso machine. And then little by little, he begins to appreciate the pleasures of life with this woman that he loves and his children and sort of suburban life. It's a very touching film. It's an adorable film. I mean, it's dated. All these old films tend to feel really dated by modern standards. And you just have to put them in the context of when they were made, not get overly offended, understand that times have changed. And in particular, recently, they changed quite quickly and rapidly. We weren't all as, you know, woke then.
Well, even, Max, you know, my wife and I were watching Rudolph, like literally it was just on and like it was Tuesday or whatever. It was a night like there wasn't a game on or anything we cared about. And I watched it and like, Santa was kind of a prick in 1961 in Claymation. You know what I mean? Like, that wasn't not a nice Santa. You know what I mean?
And uncles can bounce.
Right. So, you know, there even comes a point where a mean Santa was in someone's mind 60 years ago in Claymation. And we can't edit mean Santa. Part of mean Santa put his foot up Rudolph's backside and sent him out in the wilderness to come back and have a, you know, very Merry Christmas.
But it gave us the Island of Misfit Toys, one of the greatest metaphors.
Wow. Where Max and I were for years when she was at the City Paper and I was running around doing radio.
Before we jump to Max's Twitter feed, which we could spend 5 hours talking about, Max, the big debate right now, and I really want you to weigh in on this.
Okay.
It has to do with, and we're going to give you plenty of time to beat up on Aaron Sorkin, one of my all-time heroes. That's going to be great. You're going to crush me because I'm one of those men that you talk about that loves Aaron Sorkin. But let's talk about what happened to Spielberg's West Side Story and its opening numbers, $10.1 million, I think, less than In the Heights. But the question it raises for me, and what I want you to wax philosophically about, are we seeing the demise of the multiplex as we know it?
I mean, I don't. I think it's premature to say. The film industry was struggling before COVID, and that's for a variety of reasons. One, because there's so much entertainment that people have access to right on their computers, whether it's computer games, streaming, YouTube, TikTok, whatever. So there was always this enormous amount of competition. Then when you throw in a global pandemic and people are afraid to go to the movies, it's going to take even more of a hit. Then they started sort of changing their model. And in some cases, they were putting films out simultaneously in theaters. Like, for example, King Richard, which was a great film about Richard Williams, Serena and Venus's dad with Will Smith giving a performance that may very well get him an Oscar. Well, that was put on HBO Max and put in theaters at the same time, and it didn't do well in theaters. I don't know what kind of numbers it did on HBO Max. I suspect much, much better. So I think that the film studios and the multiplexes, they're going to have to figure something out. But you know, I would say that people are always going to want to go see movies. There is something about that special feeling of going into a theater, and the lights going down and you're having this collective experience, and that's never going to change. But I think there probably will be fewer movie theaters. You know, it's sort of like, I was, you know, 20 years ago, we were saying there aren't going to be independent bookstores anymore because we've got, you know, Borders, and we've got, which is not closed, and we've got Barnes & Noble, and we've got Amazon, which is, you know, just gobbling up this. Well, people began to crave the experience of going to an independent bookseller and having somebody who knows them recommend books and having that community. And I feel like it's the same with theaters. There's going to definitely still be movie theaters. People are always going to want to go to movie theaters. But yeah, I do think there will be fewer. And by the way, West Side Story is great. It's a great movie.
I read your review. Yeah.
By the way, my wife has never seen West Side Story, knows a little bit about, you know, I like to live in America, you know, like whatever. But it came on, the original film came on, and we stayed with it 5 minutes of them dancing up and down the street and the fake fighting of the, like all of that going on. And the guy who's Latin that doesn't really look Latin playing the Latin guy that does, I look sort of more Latin than him because I am. We couldn't stay with it. Jen just, and we're not anti-theater. We went to Tootsie 2 weeks ago, and there is a part, like Don's kid doesn't like the theater. I have Jeff on. Jeff's selling my house. Thanks, Moeller and Gary.
I know, he's an embarrassment. I love my son. I told him, I failed him on that front. He doesn't like
me. Yeah, it's hokey to him. And at 53, I can get past like cartoons and things that aren't real to say I'm in the experience of doing this. But, the West Side Story thing, I've been saying to my wife for 20 years, West Side Story's freaking great. When we were in London, it was playing and we were there for the football game, and I'm like, here's your chance, it's right here, you know. And so she watched 5 minutes of it, and the old movie kind of made her say, like, well, this isn't making me want to go spend $18 and go to the theater to see the remake or whatever. I think there is something about Broadway, and I keep Don out of this, that the dated part of this, there is a hill to climb to get 20-year-olds. And you said something like there will always be a theater that people will always want to come and sit. Maybe for always for people your age and my age as we age, but I don't know. I don't know the 20. Dom would say there'll always be baseball. And I'm like, okay. I mean, they told me there'd always be horse racing and like all of these other things. Things do come and go. And for me, the Broadway and the getting together and the movie thing, it's tougher and tougher, I think, to find the new audience amongst Don's grandchildren, an example.
I would tell you that I just got back. We're going to talk about it on the recon. Broadway was packed. Now, unfortunately, and Max, we chatted about this off the air, and I didn't realize this until I was sitting in the train station last night getting ready to come back. We were with two other couples, and I went to get a cup of coffee. And I came back, and one of my friends said, you're not going to believe this. He said, we lucked out. We saw A Girl from North Country, which was absolutely brilliant. It's a show about Depression era family and all that goes with that. And the score to the Broadway musical was Bob Dylan music, which is as poetic as ever. But yesterday in New York, a number of shows were canceled because of COVID. They're going through what the NFL and the NBA are. So we probably came within a whisker of not being able to see the show that we had had tickets for months.
Max, I'll give you a Broadway story. I want to jump in on this because Mike Flynn, the center from the Ravens Super Bowl team, you remember Mike, Max?
Well, you're talking about Max Superfan. It could be Max the girl Superfan.
So Max, I got a story for you, all right? Mike and Mary – we attended their wedding back in 03. They made a baby around that period of time when Mike was still playing for the Ravens. That baby is now the lead in Mrs. Doubtfire. He was the lead in Willy Wonka before COVID. When he was 10 or 11, he was Charlie Bucket. And now he got the gig for Mrs. Doubtfire when he was like 13, like Peter Brady, and went on COVID. And 2 years later, he almost aged out. And there was a big story in New York about him almost aging out of Mrs. Doubtfire. So there's a local angle for you. And if I were pitching in your offices, I would give you that one, Max.
Max, where are you on COVID and all that? Where are you right now mentally about COVID, Omicron? What the heck is going on? I mean, I saw the headlines this morning, and I got to tell you, I'm worn out.
That's exactly the way I feel. I am so ready to put this darn thing in my rear view mirror. I really thought I was seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. I was beginning to resume some, not, I've been very careful. I haven't gone to the theater very much. When I have gone, I have worn a mask the entire time. And I have only gone when the theater was relatively empty so I could socially distance. Okay, so I'm not even going back to the movies. I've gone to restaurants, but mostly I sit outside. If I must sit inside, only a restaurant that has lots of space so you can socially distance. Even with that, you know, but I was sort of beginning to ease into more of my regular activities. Now, this Omicron thing is, it is bumming me out, dude, because I am, I've got my two vaccines, I've got my booster, and I'm, right. I was feeling fortified, and I still am. I feel much safer than I did, you know, a year and a half ago, for sure. But, man, I just wanted to go. I'm just like everybody else. I wanted to go away. And I also wish, and I know that they just can't, I wish there was more consistent information about what the dangers are, what you can do, what you can't do, because, and it's not because they're trying to deceive us. I mean, that's silly. It's because they're learning as they go as well. And this, especially because this thing keeps morphing into different variations. They don't know about Omicron. Like, so far it seems like it's not causing a lot of severe illness, but we don't know that for sure. That could change. It's definitely scary. And I am tired. I'm just like everybody else. I was thinking this was going to be it. It was going to be over. And now it's like, geez, are we ever going to get out of this darn thing?
Don, yeah. Did you feel safe in New York?
I did. I'll tell you both one story. And Nestor, we will probably expand upon this later in the recon. I want to leave enough time here to highlight, as I said, some of Max's recent tweets. The theater was packed. And the restaurants were packed, so that when Mayor de Blasio says New York is back, absolutely.
Who's wearing a mask?
In the theater, I was both at Radio City at a couple that had never with us who had never seen the Christmas Spectacular. So, you know, you're never too old to see the Christmas Spectacular. In Radio City, it's one of the silliest rules. You wear a mask if you're not vaccinated, and you don't have to wear a mask if you are. So I guess it's the honor system. I said, this laughed to my wife. I said, yeah, so I'm nutty enough not to be vaccinated, but I'm going to go ahead and put a mask on just to keep you safe.
But they would let unvaccinated people in?
Yeah. At Radio
City. You have to show your card.
You did. You had to show your card and you had to show your ID. Now, at Broadway, you had to wear a mask. And here's my story. This is still bizarre to me. It's about 2 minutes to curtain. It's a small theater, the Belasco. It's one of those ones that, I don't know, I can't count, probably holds 2,500 people, whatever it is. And all of a sudden, I hear this ruckus, and everybody's masked up. And actually, ushers are walking up and down the aisle with things that says, mask up, mask up. And if they'd see someone, you know, with the mask down below their nose, which drives my wife insane, they would go and pull it up. Heard this ruckus, and I saw two police officers. And I saw one man starting to scream. I paid $100 for this ticket. I paid $100 for this ticket. How dare you tell me I'm going to leave? And the guy, rather than put the mask on, got thrown out of the theater. He cared enough about this content that he wanted to see this show, but rather than put his mask on, he chose to have the police throw him out of the theater. I don't know. That's where Max is. I'm so tired of it all. I don't know what to say about that guy, Matt. I mean, Max, you take us down another crazy. We talk about crazy, a little bit of crazy. That's where your Twitter feed, it makes me laugh. It makes me shake my head. It makes me mad. I mean, you posted this smiling picture. Nestor, I don't know if you've seen it yet. Max has posted this smiling picture of this all-American young man that anybody would want at their Hanukkah dinner or their Christmas dinner. It's young Kyle Rittenhouse. And he's going to be the guest speaker at a conference sponsored by Turning Point USA. Max, talk about that tweet. I looked at that and just shook my head.
It's so depressing that Kyle Rittenhouse, a troubled young man, without a doubt, who killed people, has turned into a hero to some people, that is really depressing. Like, even if you think that what he did was self-defense, and we could argue that, I don't think it was. I think he went strapped up looking for trouble with his fantasy of being a vigilante. But that's my opinion. I wasn't on the jury. So be it. He was found innocent. But to prop him up like a hero when he is a murderer is, it's depressing. And to me, it speaks to a soul sickness that we have in this country right now. And I don't know how we crawl out of it. You know, I mean, it's very, very, it's demoralizing.
Max, this is what makes Nestor crazy. I guess in that, maybe it was the O'Reilly thing, or it was another interview that Trump recently did. And again, I had to play it back and say to my wife, watch this. You're not going to believe this. It was when Trump was asked, I don't want Nestor's head to explode, which leaders he really enjoyed working with. And the first thing he did, of course, was to say, well, he didn't enjoy working with any of the Democratic leaders, the Angela Merkels and the other. They were weak. He didn't enjoy that. The ones he really liked were the cheese and the Putins. And he said, I know people don't like it when I say this, but my very favorite of all was Kim Jong-un. And people in the audience applauded.
No. He wrote in beautiful letters.
Well, he said, and Nestor, in the interview, he went back to the letters and he said, people make fun of me when I say they were love letters, but they truly were beautiful love letters. Now, Max, come on. You're the social critic. You're the social commentator. Sort this out for us and our audience.
I wish I could. The only thing that I will say is, if you do, I know you love my Twitter feed, and thank you for that. Don is my number one fan of my Twitter feed, I talk about politics, I talk about pop culture, I make jokes, I do it all, but I talk about fandom, okay? And fandom is when you associate a huge chunk of your personality and who you are with whatever you're a fan of, to the point where it becomes the primary way that you define yourself. So whether it's you're a Marvel or a DC Comics fan, or in this case, you're a fan of Donald Trump. And I believe that, and it's sort of similar to a cult, you know, it has overlaps to that kind of thing, that when you completely give your identity over to somebody, then you have no critical acumen. You've lost all critical capacity. So when somebody like Trump says, Putin's a great guy, Kim Jong-un's a great guy, you don't say, wait, that doesn't sound right. These guys are murderous dictators. You say, if my guy says it, it must be true. And that's the situation that we're in right now, that we have people who have lost all capacity to think for themselves because they are part of a fandom, the fandom of Trump. And you could call it a tribe, you can call it a cult, I call it a fandom. And it's very scary because you have to step outside of yourself and say, wait a second, 150,000 people who are unvaccinated have died since June. I just heard that statistic this morning. So people are literally dying to prove a point, to prove their allegiance to Trump and Trumpism. That's scary when death doesn't sway people, you know, when they are so dug in to a certain ideology and a certain allegiance. It's scary. I mean, you know, I don't like to dwell on it too much because I don't know how we dig ourselves out of it.
Correct.
But it definitely does scare me.
Well, I'm going to have you then talk about Nestor. I know you haven't seen it and you're going to go, what in the world are you talking about? But Max has identified herself now in the nation as the number one defender of a little show that just wrapped up its third season called Succession. Max, tell Nestor what Succession is and why you are fascinated by the family.
It's such a good show, Nestor. You don't watch it? It's really the best thing going right now. I mean, to me, I put it right up there.
Well, can I just ask this? Because I mean, Mueller we're in a million directions. I had some things I wanted to say about masking and whatnot, but Sex in the City is a show that, like, I watched, and you said the HBO Max about 20 minutes ago, which wasn't, like, Max Weiss. It was HBO Max, the thing, which I don't even, like, I want to watch the Sex and the City thing, I think. Do I have it or do I have to buy it? I thought it was a motion picture. I said to my wife, is it a movie? Is it? And I even saw like two of the actresses doing the stuff on TV that my wife, Kelly Ripa, like all that.
Do you have HBO?
Yes.
Well, then you have HBO Max.
Yeah.
Well, what is HBO? What does that mean? Why do they call it Max, other than name it after you?
Well, I'll let Max explain.
I'm not 100% sure, but I think that if you have HBO on your table, you have HBO Max. I think HBO Max, separate from HBO, is for people who mostly get their content
online. So yeah. I could, in my house, watch Sex and the City right now.
Oh, sure. But
see, I didn't know that.
Max is spoiled. She's going to spoil the first episode for you because she.
Well, wait, is Succession? What is that on? What channel is that?
Come back to Succession.
So it is the same thing. So I have Succession.
Have Succession.
Yes, we're going to have her talk about that. But I'm warning you, on Sex and the City, Max put out a little tweet that says, "The devil works fast, but the Peloton advertising team works faster." Now, we're not even going to ask her to explain that, Nestor.
I heard somebody dies on a Peloton and there was a lawsuit and there was I don't care about it. That's just PR bullshit.
Well,
I mean, all of that was a big – Peloton paid to get in. I mean, stop with that.
If you watched Sex and the City, who Mr.
Nestor, you're wrong. Wait, I've got to clarify this. Somebody, I don't want to spoil it. That's why I'm shaking my head, because Dom's going to spoil. Somebody dies on a Peloton. Peloton definitely did not pay for that. What they did was their rapid response team, they turned around so quickly and they created a counter ad, which was so ingenious, but required the assistance of the cast member who died on the show. Okay, that's all I'll say.
Brilliant reaction.
Well, that's what I said. They turned it into a $50 million ad campaign.
They did a great job.
But they weren't in on it from the jump. They responded to it because their stock began to plummet after this particular character broke on a Peloton.
How stupid is that?
Only the United States pop culture. Well, Master, we're going to jump back.
God, we are dumb. God, we're dumb.
My prediction is that you would absolutely... Max, I'm going to tee up Succession, and then the Roy family, and then I'm going to have you talk about why you love it, because you do. You elevate it to one of the best thing streaming now, maybe of all time, and I don't want to overstate.
Well, it's not the best show of all time, but I put it in the same category as The Wire, Mad Men.
That's what I mean.
Breaking Bad, Sopranos. It's up there with that quality.
You have it in that category. Now, I will tell you. Yeah. That a couple of years ago,
you got me Googling it now.
I watched a couple of episodes and I thought, and this is probably what you hear, and then I'm going to shut up and have you defend it. I thought, I don't like one person. I got to have a rooting interest for someone. So I stopped. And then people like you and others shamed me to say, come on, dummy, go back and give it another try. So several months ago, I went back to season one, and just last week wrapped up the third season. I have a question for you, Max, the girl pop critic. Is the Frank Rich, that's the executive producer, the New York Times Frank Rich?
Yeah.
Okay, so now it makes some sense to me, the Trump wannabes.
So it's sort of a Dallas for a broken family. I'm reading it like a satirical.
Well, now we're going to shut up and let Max tell us what it is.
Well, you know, it's funny. You love Ted Lasso. The last time I was here, I told you I didn't love Ted Lasso. It's too cutesy, sentimental, whatever. Succession is the anti-Ted Lasso. Like, if you can
I let you shame me into Succession. I encouraged you to go back and finish Lasso and told you that I thought as you got into the second season, you would see a depth. You didn't let me shame you into that, did you?
I didn't. Sorry.
Okay.
Don, there's so much content out there.
Go ahead.
And that's the thing. Sometimes you just say, this is not for me. You know, God bless. I'm glad you love it. It's not for me. But
I said that about Jethro Tull back in the 80s. Yes.
Exactly. Who needs a flute in a band? Anyway.
Right. Correct.
Success. What do you like about the Roy family? What do you find compelling?
Well, I don't think that you need to like somebody. I don't find that to be a criteria. I find them fascinating and funny. And, you know, the dialogue is razor sharp and the intrigue and the scenarios. I mean, it has a sort of, you know, you said Dallas, almost like a Game of Thrones type thing, because they're all vying to get to the top of the company. But the problem is the father, the patriarch. First of all, he resents his children because they were born with silver spoons in their mouth, and he is a self-made man. Second of all, he is smarter, has more killer instincts, is more ruthless than his kids could ever be. So they're all just sort of stumbling all over themselves. It's definitely sort of a dark comedy with elements of tragedy. I will say, you do start to care about these characters despite yourself, right? You start to love them or love to hate them, and particularly Kendall, who is sort of the main of the kids, I would say. I mean, he's a tragic figure.
I call him Don Jr. I call him Don Jr.
Yes, well, I mean, in the same way that Don Jr. is sort of a tragic figure, right, always trying to look for the love of his father that he is never going to achieve.
Correct.
Kendall is, I mean, he's ridiculous, right? He's like one of these guys who like tries to be hip and tries to speak in the lingo and is always listening to rap music and thinks of himself as like the cool guy when he's kind of ridiculous. But he's also like, he really tries to be a good person and kind of worries about not being a good person and tries to get the love of his and respect of his father. So you get invested in the relationship. The acting is amazing. It's just really funny, too. It is so sharply written that, you know, the creator of the show is British. And I will say, nobody can do sort of razor sharp wit and dialogue like those Brits, man. I mean, it's just you sit there with your mouth open. The acting is great. I'm so into it. Like,
so, okay, so how many episodes? Three seasons, four? So what's my investment in this? This is always my ask, you know, like, all right, good. How much does a deck cost? What does it cost me?
It took me a couple months.
I think it's 10 episodes. It's 10 episodes a season, I believe.
So. And they're hour-longers?
Yeah, hour-long.
So you're 40 hours into this thing, kind of, sort of.
30 okay. Hours.
All right.
Oh, it took me, you know, if you watch a couple of weeks.
Sex in the City's a half an hour, like in 10 episodes, right? So it was always kind of quick. That's why I could kind of hang with it. Yeah. Max Weiss is our guest. She does Baltimore Magazine. They hold the magazine up, Don. That's what you do.
Yeah.
Like Teitelbaum. We'll appreciate that, by the way.
I know. Let's not let her get out of here before I want to. She broke my heart this week, Nestor. She broke my heart. I worship at the altar of Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
And she took my boy Sorkin to task about favoring male-centric characters and making men the savior of the world. What you say, Max, the girl?
Well, he does do that. He loves a great man movie. And you know why he loves a great man movie so much? Because he sees himself as a great man. That's the honest to God truth. So he's got this new movie, Being the Ricardos, about, you know, Lucille and Desi Arnaz. And I was excited because I thought he's finally going to make a movie about a brilliant woman, you know, arguably the greatest, certainly female comedian and possibly even comedian, full stop, of all time. And yet, the film is as much, if not more, about Desi. And it almost seems like his entire reason for making the film is to sort of give Desi the credit which he so richly deserves for being a great man. And I'm like, ay-yay-yay, are you kidding me?
He did it again.
Steel ball. And it's actually about Desi. Yeah, it's a good film. It's enjoyable. Some critics have raked it over the coals. I will not do that. It's one of these films where it's just so easy to watch, enjoyable. Nicole Kidman is surprisingly great as Lucille Ball.
Is she the new Meryl Streep, Max? She started to exceed my expectations in every role. Is she the new Meryl?
I don't know about that, but she is really a great actress. And I will say that this surprised me because I thought it was bad casting. Not just because she doesn't look like her, although she looks enough like her, but because I just didn't think she could be funny. Like, you don't think, oh, Nicole Kidman, she's, what a laugh riot, what a knee slapper she is. But you know what? She's funny in this role, but she also gets at Lucille's, she was sexy. You know, she had a Katharine Hepburn thing happening, and she gets at that as well as the humor and the way she could sort of turn it off and on. And then Javier Bardem, as Desi Arnaz. Now, you look at him and say, this is terrible casting. He's kind of lumpy. He doesn't look anything at all like Desi Arnaz. I mean, he's a sexy, handsome guy, too, but very different kind of look. He's so good, too. He just captures the guy's essence. And so it's not an impersonation. It's not Rich Little. It's not what you're going to see on Saturday Night Live. It's two really talented actors embodying these roles. So for all of my annoyance with Aaron Sorkin and all of his shticks, I do recommend seeing Being the Ricardos, and I did review that one. I didn't review West Side Story, by the way, Don. You must have just seen my Twitter
feed. Maybe it was just a comment you made about it.
Yeah, it was probably just my Twitter feed, but if you go to either Rotten Tomatoes and look me up, or you go to BaltimoreMagazine.com and look up my reviews, or my Twitter feed, you'll see I did review Being the Ricardos.
But does Being the Ricardos have the Sorkin pity-pat dialogue, which I just am such a fan of?
He can't escape that. He can't escape that. It's entertaining. It's just that everybody talks that way in his movies. And it's not the way everybody talks in real life, And it's funny because I was just praising that with Succession. Succession is a very enclosed world. They also have that rat-tat-tat kind of dialogue. It's even better and sharper than what Aaron Sorkin does. But you do begin to buy into the rhythm of that in a particular TV show. It's just when it's every single one of his movies, you start saying enough,
Max, who are the leaders in the clubhouse for Best Picture?
Belfast, which I just thought was so-so. The Power of the Dog, which is fantastic. Jane Campion film. West Side Story is certainly up there in consideration. I would say those right now are the number one contenders. At this point, I would say the fact that West Side Story did not do well at the box office might actually hurt its chances.
Right.
I love The Power of the Dog, the Jane Campion film. If you can see that, I highly recommend it. That has a chance, and so does Belfast, which I thought was a mediocrity. But I think West Side Story right now might be considered the front runner.
All right, Max Weiss, you can find her at Baltimore Magazine. Max, I'm going to get you out for the crab cake tour at some point, masked up and stuff like that. Don and I are going to talk about the banner party the other night where I saw your publisher, Mike Teitelbaum, and stuff. Happy holidays to you and to everybody over there. And, I hope we all get out ice skating and eating some good food and going to Royal Farms and doing all that in the new year. All right?
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
Okay, great seeing you, Max. Max the Girl on Twitter. Doesn't get any better.
There she goes. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, doing the happy holidays thing, doing the football thing, and hanging out, doing some BaltimorePositive.com.